highway that bordered an open and uncluttered beach. Cars were parked along the pavement, facing out to sea, dark. The lights of the beach club were a few hundred yards away. I braked the car against the curb and switched the headlights off and sat with my hands on the wheel. Under the thinning fog, the surf curled and creamed, almost without sound, like a thought trying to form itself on the edge of consciousness.
"Move closer,"
she said almost thickly. I moved out from under the wheel into the middle of the seat. She turned her body a little away from me as if to peer out of the window. Then she let herself fall backwards, without a sound, into my arms. Her head almost struck the wheel. Her eyes were closed, her face was dim. Then I saw that her eyes opened and flickered, the shine of them visible even in the darkness.
"Hold me close, you beast,"
she said. I put my arms around her loosely at first. Her hair had a harsh feeling against my face. I tightened my arms and lifted her up. I brought her face slowly up to my face. Her eyelids were flickering rapidly like moth wings. I kissed her, tightly and quickly. Then a long, slow, clinging kiss. Her lips opened under mine. Her body began to shake in my arms.
"Kill her,"
she said softly, her breath going into my mouth. I strained her against me until the shivering of her body was almost shaking mine. I kept on kissing her. After a long time, she pulled her head away enough to say,
"Where do you live?"
"Hobart Arms, Franklin, near Kenmore."
"I've never seen it."
"Want to?"
"Yes."
"What has Eddie Mars got on you?" Her body stiffened in my arms, and her breath made a harsh sound. Her head pulled back until her eyes, wide open, ringed with white, were staring at me.
"So that's the way it is,"
she said in a soft, dull voice. "That's the way it is. Kissing is nice, but your father didn't hire me to sleep with you."
"You son of a bitch,"
she said calmly, without moving. I laughed in her face. "Don't think I'm an icicle," I said. "I'm not blind or without senses. I have warm blood like the next guy. You're easy to take. Too damned easy. What has Eddie Mars got on you?"
"If you say that again, I'll scream."
"Go ahead and scream." She jerked away and pulled herself upright, far back in the corner of the car.
"Men have been shot for little things like that, Marlowe."
"Men have been shot for practically nothing. The first time we met, I told you I was a detective. Get it through your lovely head. I work at it, lady. I don't play at it." She fumbled in her bag and got a handkerchief out and bit on it. Her head turned away from me. The tearing sound of the handkerchief came to me. She tore it with her teeth, slowly, time after time.
"What makes you think he has anything on me?"
she whispered, her voice muffled by the handkerchief. "He lets you win a lot of money and sends a gun poke around to take it back for him. You're not more than mildly surprised. You didn't even thank me for saving it for you. I think the whole thing was just some kind of an act. If I wanted to flatter myself, I'd say it was at least partly for my benefit."
"You think he can win or lose as he pleases?"
"Sure, on even money bets, 4 times out of 5.
"Do I have to tell you I loathe your guts, Mr. Detective?"
"You don't owe me anything. I'm paid off." She tossed the shredded handkerchief out of the car window.
"You have a lovely way with women."
"I like kissing you."
"You kept your head beautifully. That's so flattering. Should I congratulate you or my father?"
"I liked kissing you." Her voice became an icy drawl.
"Take me away from here, if you will be so kind. I'm quite sure I'd like to go home."
"You won't be a sister to me?"
"If I had a razor, I'd cut your throat just to see what ran out of it."
"Caterpillar blood," I said. I started the car and turned it and drove back across the interurban tracks to the highway and so on into town and up to West Hollywood. She didn't speak to me. She hardly moved all the way back. I drove through the gates and up the sunken driveway to the porte cochere of the big house. She jerked the car door open and was out of it before it had quite stopped. She didn't speak even then. I watched her back as she stood against the door after ringing the bell. The door opened and Norris looked out. She pushed past him quickly and was gone. The door banged shut and I was sitting there looking at it. I turned back down the driveway and home. 24. The apartment house lobby was empty this time, no gunman waiting under the potted palm to give me orders. I took the automatic elevator up to my floor and walked along the hallway to the tune of a muted radio behind a door. I needed a drink and was in a hurry to get one. I didn't switch the light on inside the door. I made straight for the kitchenette and brought up short in 3 or 4 feet. Something was wrong. Something on the air. A scent. The shades were down at the windows, and the street light leaking in at the sides made a dim light in the room. I stood still and listened. The scent on the air was a perfume. A heavy, cloying perfume. There was no sound. No sound at all. Then my eyes adjusted themselves more to the darkness, and I saw there was something across the floor in front of me that shouldn't have been there. I backed, reached the wall switch with my thumb, and flicked the light on. The bed was down. Something in it giggled. A blonde head was pressed into my pillow. Two bare arms curved up, and the hands belonging to them were clasped on top of the blonde head. Carmen Sternwood lay on her back, in my bed, giggling at me. The tawny wave of her hair was spread out on the pillow as if by a careful and artificial hand. Her slaty eyes peered at me and had the effect, as usual, of peering from behind a barrel. She smiled. Her small, sharp teeth glinted.
"Cute, aren't I?"
she said. I said harshly, "Cute as a Filipino on a Saturday night." I went over to a floor lamp and pulled the switch, went back to put off the ceiling light, and went across the room again to the chessboard on a card table under the lamp. There was a problem laid out on the board, a six-mover. I couldn't solve it like a lot of my problems. I reached down and moved a knight, then pulled my hat and coat off and threw them somewhere. All this time, the soft giggling went on from the bed, that sound that made me think of rats behind a wainscoting in an old house.
"I bet you can't even guess how I got in."
I dug a cigarette out and looked at her with bleak eyes. "I bet I can." "You came through the keyhole, just like Peter Pan."
"Who's he?"
"Oh, a fellow I used to know around the pool room." She giggled.
"You're cute, aren't you?"
she said. I began to say, "About that thumb," but she was ahead of me. I didn't have to remind her. She took her right hand from behind her head and started sucking the thumb and eyeing me with very round and naughty eyes.
"I'm all undressed,"
she said after I had smoked and stared at her for a minute. "By God," I said. "It was right at the back of my mind. I was groping for it. I almost had it when you spoke. In another minute, I'd have said, 'I bet you're all undressed.' I always wear my rubbers in bed myself in case I wake up with a bad conscience and have to sneak away from it."
"You're cute."
She rolled her head a little, kittenishly. Then she took her left hand from under her head and took hold of the covers, paused dramatically, and swept them aside. She was undressed, all right. She lay there on the bed in the lamplight as naked and glistening as a pearl. The Sternwood girls were giving me both barrels that night. I pulled a shred of tobacco off the edge of my lower lip. "That's nice," I said, "but I've already seen it all, remember? I'm the guy that keeps finding you without any clothes on." She giggled some more and covered herself up again. "Well, how did you get in?" I asked her.
"The manager let me in. I showed him your card. I'd stolen it from Vivian. I told him you told me to come here and wait for you. I was mysterious."
She glowed with delight. "Neat," I said. "Managers are like that. Now I know how you got in. Tell me how you're going to go out." She giggled.
"Not going. Not for a long time. I like it here. You're cute."
"Listen," I pointed my cigarette at her. "Don't make me dress you again. I'm tired. I appreciate all you're offering me. It's just more than I could possibly take. Doghouse Riley never let a pal down that way. I'm your friend. I won't let you down, in spite of yourself. You and I have to keep on being friends, and this isn't the way to do it. Now will you dress like a nice little girl?" She shook her head from side to side. "Listen," I plowed on. "You don't really care anything about me. You're just showing how naughty you can be. But you don't have to show me. I knew it already. I'm the guy that found..."
"Put the light out,"
she giggled. I threw my cigarette on the floor and stamped on it. I took a handkerchief out and wiped the palms of my hands. I tried it once more. "It isn't on account of the neighbors," I told her. "They don't really care a lot. There's a lot of stray broads in any apartment house, and one more won't make the building rock. It's a question of professional pride. You know, professional pride. I'm working for your father. He's a sick man, very frail, very helpless. He sort of trusts me not to pull any stunts. Won't you please Get dressed, Carmen.
Your name isn't Doc Hess Riley,
she said.
It's Philip Marlowe. You can't fool me.
I looked down at the chessboard. The move with the knight was wrong. I put it back where I had moved it from. Knights had no meaning in this game. It wasn't a game for knights. I looked at her again. She lay still now, her face pale against the pillow, her eyes large and dark and empty as rain barrels in a drought. One of her small, five-fingered, thumbless hands picked at the cover restlessly. There was a vague glimmer of doubt starting to get born in her somewhere. She didn't know about it yet. It's so hard for women, even nice women, to realize that their bodies are not irresistible. I said, I'm going out in the kitchen and mix a drink. Want one?
Uh-huh.
Dark, silent, mystified eyes stared at me solemnly, the doubt growing larger in them, creeping into them noiselessly, like a cat in long grass stalking a young blackbird. If you're dressed when I get back, you'll get the drink, okay? Her teeth parted and a faint hissing noise came out of her mouth. She didn't answer me. I went out of the kitchenette and got out some scotch and fizz water and mixed a couple of highballs. I didn't have anything really exciting to drink, like nitroglycerin or distilled tiger's breath. She hadn't moved when I got back with the glasses. The hissing had stopped. Her eyes were dead again. Her lips started to smile at me, then she sat up suddenly and threw all the covers off her body and reached.
Gimme.
When you're dressed, not until you're dressed. I put the two glasses down on the card table and sat down myself and lit another cigarette. Go ahead, I won't watch you. I looked away. Then I was aware of the hissing noise, very sudden and sharp. It startled me into looking at her again. She sat there naked, propped on her hands, her mouth open a little, her face like scraped bone. The hissing noise came tearing out of her mouth as if she had nothing to do with it. There was something behind her eyes, blank as they were, that I had never seen in a woman's eyes. Then her lips moved very slowly and carefully, as if they were artificial lips and had to be manipulated with springs. She called me a filthy name. I didn't mind that. I didn't mind what she called me, what anybody called me. But this was the room I had to live in. It was all I had in the way of a home. In it was everything that was mine, that had any association for me, any past, anything that took the place of a family. Not much, a few books, pictures, radio, chessmen, old letters, stuff like that. Nothing. Such as they were, they had all my memories. I couldn't stand her in that room any longer. What she called me only reminded me of that. I said, carefully, I'll give you 3 minutes to get dressed and out of here. If you're not out by then, I'll throw you out, by force, just the way you are, naked, and I'll throw your clothes after you into the hall. Now, get started. Her teeth chattered and the hissing noise was sharp and animal. She swung her feet to the floor and reached for her clothes on a chair beside the bed. She dressed. I watched her. She dressed with stiff, awkward fingers. For a woman, but quickly at that. She was dressed in a little over 2 minutes. I timed it. She stood there beside the bed, holding a green bag tied against a fur-trimmed coat. She wore a rakish green hat, crooked, on her head. She stood there for a moment and hissed at me, her face still like scraped bone, her eyes still empty and yet full of some jungle emotion. Then she walked quickly to the door and opened it and went out, without speaking, without looking back. I heard the elevator lurch into motion and move in the shaft. I walked to the windows and pulled the shades up and opened the windows wide. The night air came drifting in with a kind of stale sweetness that still remembered automobile exhausts and the streets of the city. I reached for my drink and drank it slowly. The apartment house door closed itself down below me. Steps tinkled on the quiet pavement. A car started up not far away. It rushed off into the night with a rough clashing of gears. I went back to the bed and looked down at it. The imprint of her head was still in the pillow, of her small, corrupt body still on the sheets. I put my empty glass down and tore the bed to pieces, savagely. 25. It was raining again the next morning. A slanting gray rain like a swung curtain of crystal beads. I got up feeling sluggish and tired and stood looking out of the windows, with a dark, harsh taste of sternwoods still in my mouth. I was as empty of life as a scarecrow's pockets. I went out to the kitchenette and drank 2 cups of black coffee. You can have a hangover from other things than alcohol. I had one from women. Women made me sick. I shaved and showered and dressed and got my raincoat out and went downstairs and looked out of the front door. Across the street, 100 feet up, a gray Plymouth sedan was parked. It was the same one that had tried to trail me around the day before, the same one that I had asked Eddie Mars about. There might be a cop in it, if a cop had that much time on his hands and wanted to waste it following me around, or it might be a smoothie in the detective business trying to get a nose full of somebody else's case in order to chisel a way into it, or it might be the Bishop of Bermuda disapproving of my nightlife. I went out back and got my convertible from the garage and drove it around front, past the gray Plymouth. There was a small man in it, alone. He started up after me. He worked better in the rain. He stayed close enough so that I couldn't make a short block and leave that before he entered it, and he stayed far back enough so that other cars were between us most of the time. I drove down to the boulevard and parked in the lot next to my building and came out of there with my raincoat collar up and my hat brim low and the raindrops tapping icily at my face in between. The Plymouth was across the way at a fire plug. I walked down to the intersection and crossed with the green light and walked back, close to the edge of the pavement and the parked cars. The Plymouth hadn't moved. Nobody got out of it. I reached it and jerked open the door on the curbside. A small, bright-eyed man was pressed back into the corner behind the wheel. I stood and looked in at him, the rain thumping my back. His eyes blinked behind the swirling smoke of a cigarette. His hands tapped restlessly on the thin wheel. I said, "Can't you make your mind up?" He swallowed and the cigarette bobbed between his lips.
"I don't think I know you," he said in a tight little voice.
"Marlowe's the name, the guy you've been trying to follow around for a couple of days."
"I ain't following anybody, Doc."
"This jalopy is, maybe you can't control it. Have it your own way. I am now going to eat breakfast in the coffee shop across the street. Orange juice, bacon and eggs, toast, honey, 3 or 4 cups of coffee, and a toothpick. I am then going up to my office, which is on the 7th floor of the building right opposite you. If you have anything that's worrying you beyond endurance, drop up and chew it over. I'll only be oiling my machine gun." I left him blinking and walked away. 20 minutes later, I was airing the scrub woman's soiree d'amour out of my office and opening up a thick, rough envelope addressed in a fine, old-fashioned, pointed handwriting. The envelope contained a brief formal note and a large mauve check for $500, payable to Philip Marlowe and signed Guy de Brisset Sternwood by Vincent Norris. That made it a nice morning. I was making out a bank slip when the buzzer told me somebody had entered my 2x4 reception room. It was the little man from the Plymouth. "Fine," I said. "Come in and shed your coat." He slid past me carefully as I held the door, as carefully as though he feared I might plant a kick in his minute buttocks. We sat down and faced each other across the desk. He was a very small man, not more than 5'3", and would hardly weigh as much as a butcher's thumb. He had tight, brilliant eyes that wanted to look hard, and looked as hard as oysters on the half-shell. He wore a double-breasted dark gray suit that was too wide in the shoulders and had too much lapel. Over this, open, an Irish tweed coat with some badly worn spots. A lot of foulard tie bulged out and was rain-spotted above his crossed lapels.
"Maybe you know me," he said. "I'm Harry Jones."
I said I didn't know him. I pushed a flat tin of cigarettes at him. His small, neat fingers speared one like a trout taking the fly. He lit it with the desk lighter and waved his hand.
"I've been around," he said. "Know the boys and such. Used to do a little liquor running down from Winnemi Point. A tough racket, brother. Riding the scout car with a gun in your lap and a wad on your hip that would choke a coal chute. Plenty of times we paid off 4 sets of law before we hit Beverly Hills. A tough racket."
"Terrible," I said. He leaned back and blew smoke at the ceiling from the small tight corner of his small tight mouth.
"Maybe you don't believe me," he said.
"Maybe I don't," I said. "And maybe I do. And then again, maybe I haven't bothered to make my mind up. Just what is the build-up supposed to do to me?"
"Nothing," he said tartly.
"You've been following me around for a couple of days," I said, "like a fellow trying to pick up a girl and lacking the last inch of nerve. Maybe you're selling insurance, Maybe you knew a fellow called Joe Brody. That's a lot of maybes, but I have a lot on hand in my business. His eyes bulged, and his lower lip almost fell in his lap.
Christ, how'd you know that?
He said. I'm psychic. Shake your business up and pour it. I haven't got all day. The brightness of his eyes almost disappeared between the suddenly narrowed lids. There was silence. The rain pounded down on the flat-tarred roof over the mansion house lobby below my windows. His eyes opened a little, shined again, and his voice was full of thought.
I was trying to get a line of you, sure, he said. I've got something to sell, cheap, for a couple of C-notes. How'd you tie me to Joe?
I opened a letter and read it. It offered me a 6 months correspondence course in fingerprinting at a special professional discount. I dropped it into the wastebasket and looked at the little man again. Don't mind me. I was just guessing. You're not a cop. You don't belong to Eddie Mars's outfit. I asked him last night. I couldn't think of anybody else but Joe Brody's friends who would be that much interested in me.
Jesus,
he said and licked his lower lip. His face had turned white as paper when I mentioned Eddie Mars. His mouth drooped open and his cigarette hung to the corner of it by some magic as if it had grown there.
Aw, you're kidding me,
he said at last with the sort of smile the operating room sees. All right, I'm kidding you. I opened another letter. This one wanted to sell me a daily newsletter from Washington, all inside stuff, straight from the cookhouse. I suppose Agnes is loose, I added.
Yeah, she sent me. You interested?
Well, she's a blonde.
Nuts. You made a crack when you were up there that night, the night Joe got squibbed off. Something about Brody must have known something good about the Sternwoods or he wouldn't have taken the chance on that picture he sent them.
Uh-huh. So he had? What was it?
That's what the $200 pays for.
I dropped some more fan mail into the basket and lit myself a fresh cigarette.
We gotta get out of town, he said. Agnes is a nice girl. You can't hold that stuff on her. It's not so easy for a dame to get by these days.
She's too big for you, I said. She'll roll on you and smother you.
That's kind of a dirty crack, brother, he said, with something that was near enough to dignity to make me stare at him.
I said, you're right. I've been meeting the wrong kind of people lately. Let's cut out the gabble and get down to cases. What have you got for the money?
Would you pay it?
If it does what?
If it helps you find Rusty Regan.
I'm not looking for Rusty Regan.
Says you. Want to hear it or not?
Go ahead and chirp. I'll pay for anything I use. 2 C-notes buys a lot of information in my circle.
Eddie Mars had Regan bumped off,
he said calmly and leaned back as if he had just been made a vice president. I waved a hand in the direction of the door. I wouldn't even argue with you, I said. I wouldn't waste the oxygen. On your way, small size. He leaned across the desk, white lines at the corners of his mouth. He snubbed his cigarette out carefully, over and over again without looking at it. From behind a communicating door came the sound of a typewriter clacking monotonously to the bell, to the shift, line after line.
I'm not kidding, he said.
Beat it. Don't bother me. I have work to do.
No, you don't, he said sharply. I ain't that easy. I came here to speak my piece, and I'm speaking it. I knew Rusty myself. Not well, well enough to say how's a boy, and he'd answer me, or he wouldn't, according to how he felt. A nice guy, though. I always liked him. He was sweet on a singer named Mona Grant. Then she changed her name to Mars. Rusty got sore and married a rich dame that hung around the joints like she couldn't sleep well at home. You know all about her. Tall, dark, enough looks for a derby winner, but the type would put a lot of pressure on a guy. High-strung. Rusty wouldn't get along with her, but Jesus, he'd get along with her old man's dough, wouldn't he? That's what you think. This Regan was a cockeyed sort of buzzard. He had long-range eyes. He was looking over into the next valley all the time. He wasn't scarcely around where he was. I don't think he gave a damn about dough. And coming from me, brother, that's a compliment.
The little man wasn't so dumb after all. A 3 for a quarter grifter wouldn't even think such thoughts, much less know how to express them. I said, so he ran away.
He started to run away, maybe, with this girl Mona. She wasn't living with Eddie Mars, didn't like his rackets, especially the sidelines, like blackmail, bent cars, hideouts for hot boys from the east, and so on. The talk was Regan told Eddie one night right out in the open that if he ever messed Mona up in any criminal rap, he'd be around to see him.
Most of this is on the record, Harry, I said. You can't expect money for that.
I'm coming to what isn't. So Regan blew. I used to see him every afternoon in Vardy's drinking Irish whiskey and staring at the wall. He don't talk much anymore. He'd give me a bet now and then, which was what I was there for, to pick up bets for Puss Walgreen.
I thought he was in the insurance business.
That's what it says on the door. I guess he'd sell you insurance at that, if you tramped on him. Well, about the middle of September, I don't see Regan anymore. I don't notice it right away. You know how it is. A guy's there, and you see him, and then he ain't there, and you don't see him until something makes you think of it. What makes me think about it is I hear a guy say, laughing, that Eddie Mars's woman lammed out with Rusty Regan, and Mars is acting like he was best man instead of being sore. So I tell Joe Brody, and Joe was smart.
Like hell he was, I said.
Not copper smart, but still smart. He's out for the dough. He gets to figuring, could he get a line somehow on the two lovebirds he could maybe collect twice, once from Eddie Mars and once from Regan's wife? Joe knew the family a little.
$5,000 worth, I said. He nicked them for that a while back.
Yeah?
Harry Jones looked mildly surprised.
Agnes ought to have told me that. There's a frail for you, always holding out. Well, Joe and me watch the papers and we don't see anything, so we know old Sternwood has a blanket on it. Then one day I see Lash Canino in Vardy's. Know him?
I shook my head.
There's a boy that is tough like some guys think they are tough. He does a job for Eddie Mars when Mars needs him. Troubleshooting. He'd bump a guy off between drinks. When Mars don't need him, he don't go near him, and he don't stay in L.A. Well, it might be something and it might not. Maybe they got a line on Regan and Mars has just been sitting back with a smile on his puss, waiting for the chance. Then again, it might be something else entirely. Anyway, I tell Joe, and Joe gets on Canino's tail. He can tail. Me? I'm no good at it. I'm giving that one away. No charge. And Joe tails Canino out to the Sternwood place, and Canino parks outside the estate, and a car comes up beside him with a girl in it. They talk for a while, and Joe thinks the girl passes something over, like maybe dough. The girl beats it. It's Regan's wife. Okay, she knows Canino, and Canino knows Mars, so Joe figures Canino knows something about Regan and is trying to squeeze a little on the side for himself. Canino blows, and Joe loses him. End of Act One.
What does this Canino look like?
Short, heavy-set, brown hair, brown eyes, and always wears brown clothes and a brown hat. Even wears a brown suede raincoat. Drives a brown coupe. Everything brown for Mr. Canino.
Let's have Act Two, I said.
Without some dough, that's all.
I don't see $200 in it. Mrs. Regan married an ex-bootlegger out of the joints. She'd know other people of his sort. She knows Eddie Mars well. If she thought anything had happened to Regan, Eddie would be the very man she'd go to, and Canino might be the man Eddie would pick to handle the assignment. Is that all you have?
Would you give me the $200 to know where Eddie's wife is?
The little man asked calmly. He had all my attention now. I almost cracked the arms of my chair leaning on them.
Even if she was alone,
Harry Jones added in a soft, rather sinister tone,
even if she never ran away with Regan at all and was being kept now about 40 miles from L.A. in a hideout so the law would keep on thinking she had dusted with him, would you pay $200 for that, Seamus?
I licked my lips. They tasted dry and salty. I think I would, I said. Where?
Agnes found her,
he said grimly.
Just by a lucky break. Saw her out riding and managed to tail her home. Agnes will tell you where that is, when she's holding the money in her hand.
I made a hard face at him. You could tell the coppers for nothing, Harry. They have some good wreckers down at Central these days. If they killed you trying, they still have Agnes.
Let him try, he said. I ain't so brittle.
Agnes must have something I didn't notice.
She's a grifter, Seamus. I'm a grifter. We're all grifters. So we sell each other out for a nickel. Okay. See, you can make me.
He reached for another of my cigarettes, placed it neatly between his lips, and lit it with a match, the way I do myself, missing twice on his thumbnail and then using his foot. He puffed evenly and stared at me, level-eyed. A funny little hard guy I could have thrown from home plate to second base, a small man in a big man's world. There was something I liked about him.
"I haven't pulled anything in here," he said steadily. "I came in talking 2 C's. That's still the price. I come because I thought I'd get a take it or leave it. One right G to another. Now you're waving cops at me. You ought to be ashamed of yourself."
I said, "You'll get the 200 for that information. I have to get the money myself first." He stood up and nodded and pulled his worn little Irish tweed coat tight around his chest.
"That's okay. After dark is better anyway. It's a leery job bucking guys like Eddie Mars, but a guy has to eat. The book's been pretty dull lately. I think the big boys have told Puss Walgreen to move on. Suppose you come over there to the office, Fulwiter Building, Western in Santa Monica, 428 at the back. You bring the money, I'll take you to Agnes."
"Can't you tell me yourself? I've seen Agnes."
"I promised her," he said simply.
He buttoned his overcoat, cocked his hat jauntily, nodded again, and strolled to the door. He went out. His steps died along the hall. I went down to the bank and deposited my $500 check and drew out 200 in currency. I went upstairs again and sat in my chair thinking about Harry Jones and his story. It seemed a little too pat. It had the austere simplicity of fiction rather than the tangled woof of fact. Captain Gregory ought to have been able to find Mona Mars if she was that close to his beat. Supposing, that is, he had tried. I thought about it most of the day. Nobody came into the office. Nobody called me on the phone. It kept on raining.
26. At 7 the rain had stopped for a breathing spell, but the gutters were still flooded. On Santa Monica, the water was level with the pavement, and a thin film of it washed over the top of the curbing. A traffic cop in shining black rubber from boots to cap sloshed through the flood on his way from the shelter of a sodden awning. My rubber heels slithered on the pavement as I turned into the narrow lobby of the Fulwiter Building. A single drop light burned far back, beyond an open, once-gilt elevator. There was a tarnished and well-missed spittoon on a gnawed rubber mat. A case of false teeth hung on the mustard-colored wall like a fuse box in a screen porch. I shook the rain off my hat and looked at the building directory beside the case of teeth. Numbers with names and numbers without names. Plenty of vacancies or plenty of tenants who wished to remain anonymous. Painless dentists, shyster detective agencies, small sick businesses that had crawled there to die. Mail-order schools that would teach you how to become a railway clerk or a radio technician or a screenwriter, if the postal inspectors didn't catch up with them first. A nasty building. A building in which the smell of stale cigar butts would be the cleanest odor. An old man dozed in the elevator on a ramshackle stool with a burst-out cushion under him. His mouth was open, his veined temples glistened in the weak light. He wore a blue uniform coat that fitted him the way a stall fits a horse. Under that, gray trousers with frayed cuffs, white cotton socks, and black kid shoes, one of which was slit across a bunion. On the stool, he slept miserably, waiting for a customer. I went past him softly, the clandestine air of the building prompting me, found the fire door and pulled it open. The fire stairs hadn't been swept in a month. Bums had slept on them, eaten on them, left crusts and fragments of greasy newspaper, matches, a gutted imitation leather pocketbook. In a shadowy angle against the scribbled wall, a pouched ring of pale rubber had fallen and had not been disturbed. A very nice building. I came out at the fourth floor sniffing for air. The hallway had the same dirty spittoon and frayed mat, the same mustard walls, the same memories of low tide. I went down the line and turned a corner. The name L.D. Walgreen, Insurance, showed on a dark pebbled glass door, on a second dark door, on a third, behind which there was a light. One of the dark doors said Entrance. A glass transom was open above the lighted door. Through it, the sharp, bird-like voice of Harry Jones spoke, saying,
"Canino? Yeah, I've seen you around somewhere. Sure."
I froze. The other voice spoke. It had a heavy purr, like a small dynamo behind a brick wall. It said,
"I thought you would."
There was a vaguely sinister note in that voice. A chair scraped on linoleum. Steps sounded. The transom above me squeaked shut. A shadow melted from behind the pebbled glass. I went back to the first of the three doors marked with the name Walgreen. I tried it cautiously. It was locked. It moved in a loose frame. An old door fitted many years past, made of half-seasoned wood and shrunken now. I reached my wallet out and slipped the thick, hard window of celluloid from over my driver's license. A burglar's tool the law had forgotten to proscribe. I put my gloves on, leaned softly and lovingly against the door, and pushed the knob hard away from the frame. I pushed the celluloid plate into the wide crack and felt for the slope of the spring lock. There was a dry click, like a small icicle breaking. I hung there motionless like a lazy fish in the water. Nothing happened inside. I turned the knob and pushed the door back into darkness. I shut it behind me as carefully as I had opened it. The lighted oblong of an uncurtained window faced me, cut by the angle of a desk. On the desk, a hooded typewriter took form, then the metal knob of a communicating door. This was unlocked. I passed into the second of the three offices. Rain rattled suddenly against the closed window. Under its noise, I crossed the room. A tight fan of light spread from an inch opening of the door into the lighted office. Everything very convenient. I walked like a cat on a mantle and reached the hinged side of the door, put an eye to the crack, and saw nothing but light against the angle of the wood. The purring voice was now saying quite pleasantly,
"Sure, a guy could sit on his fanny and crab what another guy done if he knows what it's all about. So you go to see this peeper. Well, that was your mistake. Eddie don't like it. The peeper told Eddie some guy in a Great Plymouth was tailing him. Eddie naturally wants to know who and why, see?"
Harry Jones laughed lightly. "What makes it his business?"
"That don't get you no place."
"You know why I went to the peeper. I already told you. Account of Joe Brody's girl. She has to blow, and she's shatting on her uppers. She figures the peeper can get her some dough. I don't have any."
The purring voice said gently,
"Dough for what? Peepers don't give that stuff out to punks."
"He could raise it. He knows rich people."
Harry Jones laughed, a brave little laugh.
"Don't fuss with me, little man."
The purring voice had an edge like sand in the bearings.
"Okay, okay, you know the dope on Brody's bump-off. That screwy kid done it all right, but the night it happened, this Marlowe was right there in the room."
"That's known, little man. He told it to the law."
"Yeah, here's what isn't. Brody was trying to peddle a nudist photo of the young Sternwood girl. Marlowe got wise to him. While they were arguing about it, the young Sternwood girl dropped around herself with a gat. She took a shot at Brody. She lets one fly and breaks a window, only the peeper didn't tell the coppers about that, and Agnes didn't either. She figures it's railway fare for her not to."
"This ain't got anything to do with Eddie?"
"Show me how."
"Where's this Agnes at?"
"Nothing doing."
"You'll tell me, little man. Here or in the back room where the boys pitch dimes against the wall?"
"She's my girl now, Canino. I don't put my girl in the middle for anybody."
A silence followed. I listened to the rain lashing the windows. The smell of cigarette smoke came through the crack of the door. I wanted to cough, a bit hard on a handkerchief. The purring voice said, still gentle,
"From what I hear, this blonde broad was just a shill for Geiger. I'll talk it over with Eddie. How much you tap the peeper for?"
2 centuries.
"Get it?"
Harry Jones laughed again.
"I'm seeing him tomorrow. I have hopes."
"Where's Agnes?"
"Listen."
"Where's Agnes?"
Silence.
"Look at it, little man."
I didn't move. I wasn't wearing a gun. I didn't have to see through the crack of the door to know that a gun was what the purring voice was inviting Harry Jones to look at, but I didn't think Mr. Canina would do anything with his gun beyond showing it. I waited.
"I'm looking at it,"
Harry Jones said, his voice squeezed tight as if it could hardly get past his teeth.
"And I don't see anything I didn't see before. Go ahead and blast and see what it gets you."
"A Chicago overcoat is what it would get you, little man."
Silence.
"Where's Agnes?"
Harry Jones sighed.
Okay,
he said wearily. She's in an apartment house at 28 Court Street up on Bunker Hill, apartment 301. I guess I'm yellow, all right. Why should I front for that twist?
No reason. You got good sense. You and me'll go out and talk to her. All I want is to find out is she dummying up on you, kid. If it's the way you say it, everything is Jake Alou. You can put the bite on the peeper and be on your way. No hard feelings.
No, Harry Jones said. No hard feelings, Canino.
Fine. Let's dip the bill. Got a glass?
The purring voice was now as false as an usherette's eyelashes and as slippery as a watermelon seed. A drawer was pulled open. Something jarred on wood. A chair squeaked. A scuffing sound on the floor.
This is bond stuff,
the purring voice said. There was a gurgling sound.
Moths in your ermine, as the ladies say.
Harry Jones said softly,
Success.
I heard a short, sharp cough, then a violent retching. There was a small thud on the floor as if a thick glass had fallen. My fingers curled against my raincoat. The purring voice said gently,
You ain't sick from just one drink, are you, pal?
Harry Jones didn't answer. There was labored breathing for a short moment. Then thick silence folded down. Then a chair scraped.
So long, little man,
said Mr. Canino. Steps, a click, the wedge of light died at my feet. A door opened and closed quietly. The steps faded, leisurely and assured. I stirred around the edge of the door and pulled it wide and looked into blackness relieved by the dim shine of a window. The corner of a desk glittered faintly. A hunched shape took form in a chair behind it. In the close air there was a heavy, clogged smell, almost a perfume. I went across to the corridor and listened. I heard the distant clang of the elevator. I found the light switch, and light glowed in a dusty glass bowl hanging from the ceiling by three brass chains. Harry Jones looked at me across the desk, his eyes wide open, his face frozen in a tight spasm, the skin bluish. His small dark head was tilted to one side. He sat upright against the back of the chair. A tramcar bell clanged at an almost infinite distance, and the sound came buffeted by innumerable walls. A brown half-pint of whiskey stood on the desk with the cap off. Harry Jones's glass glinted against a caster of the desk. The second glass was gone. I breathed shallowly from the top of my lungs and bent above the bottle. Behind the charred smell of the bourbon, another odor lurked, faintly, the odor of bitter almonds. Harry Jones, dying, had vomited on his coat. That made it cyanide. I walked around him carefully and lifted a phone book from a hook on the wooden frame of the window. I let it fall again, reached the telephone as far as it would go from the little dead man. I dialed information. The voice answered.
Can you give me the phone number of apartment 301 28 Court Street?
One moment, please.
The voice came to me borne on the smell of bitter almonds. A silence.
The number is Wentworth 2528. It is listed under Glendower Apartments.
I thanked the voice and dialed the number. The bell rang three times, then the line opened. A radio blared along the wire and was muted. A burly male voice said,
Hello?
Is Agnes there?
No Agnes here, buddy. What number you want?
Wentworth, 2528.
Right number, wrong gal. Ain't that a shame?
The voice cackled. I hung up and reached for the phone book again and looked up the Wentworth Apartments. I dialed the manager's number. I had a blurred vision of Mr. Canino driving fast through rain to another appointment with death.
Glendower Apartments, Mr. Schiff speaking.
This is Wallace, Police Identification Bureau. Is there a girl named Agnes Lozell registered in your place?
Who did you say you were?
I told him again.
If you'll give me your number, I'll...
Cut the comedy, I said sharply. I'm in a hurry. Is there or isn't there?
No, there isn't.
The voice was as stiff as a breadstick. Is there a tall blonde with green eyes registered in the flop?
Say, this isn't any flop. Oh, can it? Can it?
I rapped at him in a police voice. You want me to send the vice squad over there and shake the joint down? I know all about Bunker Hill apartment houses, mister, especially the ones that have phone numbers listed for each apartment.
Hey, take it easy, officer. I'll cooperate. There's a couple of blondes here, sure. Where isn't there?
I hadn't noticed their eyes much. Would yours be alone?
Alone, or with a little chap about 5'3", 110, sharp black eyes, wears double-breasted dark gray suit, an Irish tweed overcoat, gray hat. My information is apartment 301, but all I get there is the big razoo.
Oh, she ain't there. There's a couple of car salesmen living in 301.
Thanks, I'll drop around.
Make it quiet, won't you? Come to my place direct.
Much obliged, Mr. Schiff. I hung up. I wiped sweat off my face. I walked to the far corner of the office and stood with my face to the wall, patted it with a hand. I turned around slowly and looked across at little Harry Jones, grimacing in his chair.
"Well, you fooled him, Harry," I said out loud in a voice that sounded queer to me. "You lied to him and you drank your cyanide like a little gentleman. You died like a poisoned rat, Harry, but you're no rat to me." I had to search him. It was a nasty job. His pockets yielded nothing about Agnes, nothing that I wanted at all. I didn't think they would, but I had to be sure. Mr. Canino might be back. Mr. Canino would be the kind of self-confident gentleman who would not mind returning to the scene of his crime. I put the light out and started to open the door. The phone bell rang jarringly down on the baseboard. I listened to it, my jaw muscles drawn into a knot, aching. Then I shut the door and put the light on again and went across to it.
Yeah?
A woman's voice. Her voice.
Is Harry around?
Not for a minute, Agnes. She waited a while on that. Then she said slowly,
Who's talking?
Marlowe, the guy that's trouble to you.
Where is he?
Sharply. I came over to give him $200 in return for certain information. The offer holds. I have the money. Where are you?
Didn't he tell you?
No.
Perhaps you'd better ask him. Where is he?
I can't ask him. Do you know a man named Canino? Her gasp came as clearly as though she had been beside me. Do you want the two C's or not? I asked.
I want it pretty bad, mister.
All right, then. Tell me where to bring it. Her voice trailed off and came back with a panic rush.
Where's Harry?
Got scared and blew. Meet me somewhere. Anywhere at all. I have the money.
I don't believe you about Harry. It's a trap.
Oh, stuff. I could have had Harry hauled in long ago. There isn't anything to make a trap for. Canino got a line on Harry somehow, and he blew. I want quiet. You want quiet. Harry wants quiet. Harry already had it. Nobody could take it away from him. You don't think I'd stooge for Eddie Mars, do you, Angel?
No, I guess not. Not that. I'll meet you in half an hour. Beside Bullock's, Wilshire, the east entrance to the parking lot.
Right, I said. I dropped the phone in its cradle. The wave of almond odor flooded me again and the sour smell of vomit. The little dead man sat silent in his chair, beyond fear, beyond change. I left the office. Nothing moved in the dingy corridor. No pebbled glass door had light behind it. I went down the fire stairs to the second floor and from there looked down at the lighted roof of the elevator cage. I pressed the button. Slowly the car lurched into motion. I ran down the stairs again. The car was above me when I walked out of the building. It was raining hard again. I walked into it with the heavy drops slapping my face. When one of them touched my tongue, I knew that my mouth was open and the ache at the side of my jaws told me it was open wide and strained back, mimicking the rictus of death carved upon the face of Harry Jones. 27.
Give me the money.
The motor of the gray Plymouth throbbed under her voice and the rain pounded above it. The violet light at the top of Bullock's green-tinged tower was far above us, serene and withdrawn from the dark, dripping city. Her black-gloved hand reached out and I put the bills in it. She bent over to count them under the dim light of the dash. A bag clicked open, clicked shut. She let a spent breath die on her lips. She leaned toward me.
I'm leaving, Copper. I'm on my way. This is a getaway stake, and God, how I need it. What happened to Harry?
I told you, he ran away. Canino got wise to him somehow. Forget Harry. I've paid, and I want my information.
You'll get it. Joe and I were out riding Foothill Boulevard Sunday before last. It was late, and the lights coming up, and the usual mess of cars. We passed a brown coupe, and I saw the girl who was driving it. There was a man beside her, a dark, short man. The girl was a blonde. I'd seen her before. She was Eddie Mars's wife. The guy was Canino. You wouldn't forget either of them if you ever saw them. Joe tailed the coupe from in front. He was good at that. Canino, the watchdog, was taking her out for air. A mile or so east of Rialito, a road turns toward the foothills. That's orange country to the south, but to the north, it's as bare as hell's backyard, and smack up against the hills, there's a cyanide plant where they make the stuff for fumigation. Just off the highway, there's a small garage and paint shop run by a G named Art Huck. Hot car drop, likely. There's a frame house beyond this, and beyond the house, nothing but the foothills and the bare stone outcrop and the cyanide plant a couple of miles on. That's the place where she's holed up. They turned off on this road, and Joe swung around and went back, and we saw the car turn off the road where the frame house was. We sat there half an hour looking through the cars going by. Nobody came back out. When it was quite dark, Joe sneaked up there and took a look. He said there were lights in the house, and a radio was going, and just the one car out in front. The coupe. So we beat it.
She stopped talking, and I listened to the swish of tires on Wilshire. I said, "They might have shifted quarters since then, but that's what you have to sell. That's what you have to sell. Sure you knew her?"
"If you ever see her, you won't make a mistake the second time. Goodbye, copper. And wish me luck. I got a raw deal."
"Like hell you did," I said, and walked away across the street to my own car. The gray Plymouth moved forward, gathered speed, and darted around the corner onto Sunset Place. The sound of its motor died, and with it, blonde Agnes wiped herself off the slate for good, so far as I was concerned. Three men dead. Geiger, Brody, and Harry Jones. And the woman went riding off in the rain with my 200 in her bag and not a mark on her. I kicked my starter and drove on downtown to eat. I ate a good dinner. 40 miles in the rain is a hike, and I hoped to make it a round trip. I drove north across the river, on into Pasadena, through Pasadena, and almost at once I was in orange groves. The tumbling rain was solid white spray in the headlights. The windshield wiper could hardly keep the glass clear enough to see through, but not even the drenched darkness could hide the flawless lines of the orange trees wheeling away like endless spokes into the night. Cars passed with a tearing hiss and a wave of dirty spray. The highway jerked through a little town that was all packing houses and sheds and railway sidings nuzzling them. The groves thinned out and dropped away to the south, and the road climbed, and it was cold. And to the north the black foothills crouched closer and sent a bitter wind whipping down their flanks. Then faintly, out of the dark, two yellow vapor lights glowed high up in the air, and a neon sign between them said, "Welcome to Rialito." Frame houses were spaced far back from a wide main street, then a sudden knot of stores, the lights of a drugstore behind fogged glass, the fly cluster of cars in front of a movie theater, a dark bank on a corner with a clock sticking out over the pavement and a group of people standing in the rain looking at its windows, as if they were some kind of a show. I went on. Empty fields closed in again. Fate stage-managed the whole thing. Beyond Rialito, just about a mile beyond, the highway took a curve and the rain fooled me and I went too close to the shoulder. My right front tire let go with an angry hiss. Before I could stop, the right rear went with it. I jammed the car to a stop, half on the pavement, half on the shoulder, got out and flashed a spotlight around. I had two flats and one spare. The flat butt of a heavy galvanized tack stared at me from the front tire. The edge of the pavement was littered with them. They had been swept off, but not far enough off. I snapped the flash off and stood there breathing rain and looking up a side road at a yellow light. It seemed to come from a skylight. The skylight could belong to a garage. The garage could be run by a man named Art Huck, and there could be a frame house next door to it. I tucked my chin down in my collar and started towards it, then went back to unstrap the license holder from the steering post and put it in my pocket. I leaned lower under the wheel. Behind a weighted flap, directly under my right leg as I sat in the car, there was a hidden compartment. There were two guns in it. One belonged to Eddie Mars's boy Lanny, and one belonged to me. I took Lanny's. It would have had more practice than mine. I stuck it nose down in an inside pocket and started up the side road. The garage was 100 yards from the highway. It showed the highway a blank sidewall. I played the flash on it quickly. Art Huck, motor repairs, and painting. I chuckled. Then Harry Jones's face rose up in front of me, and I stopped, chuckling. The garage doors were shut, but there was an edge of light under them and a thread of light where the halves met. I went on past. The frame house was there. Light in 2 front windows, shades down. It was set well back from the road, behind a thin clump of trees. A car stood on the gravel drive in front. It was dark, indistinct, but it would be a brown coupe, and it would belong to Mr. Canino. It squatted there peacefully in front of the narrow wooden porch. He would let her take it out for a spin once in a while, and sit beside her, probably with a gun handy. The girl Rusty Regan ought to have married, that Eddie Mars couldn't keep, the girl that hadn't run away with Regan. Nice, Mr. Canino. I trudged back to the garage and banged on the wooden door with the butt of my flash. There was a hung instant of silence as heavy as thunder. The light inside went out. I stood there grinning and licking the rain off my lip. I clicked the spot on the middle of the doors. I grinned at the circle of white. I was where I wanted to be. A voice spoke through the door, a surly voice.
"What do you want?"
"Open up. I've got 2 flats back on the highway and only 1 spare. I need help."
"Sorry, mister. We're closed up. Rialito's 1 mile west. Better try there."
I didn't like that. I kicked the door hard. I kept on kicking it. Another voice made itself heard. A purring voice, like a small dynamo behind a wall. I liked this voice. It said,
"A wise guy, huh? Open up, Art."
A bolt squeaked and half of the door bent inward. My flash burned briefly on a gaunt face, then something that glittered swept down and knocked the flash out of my hand. A gun had peeked at me. I dropped low where the flash burned on the wet ground and picked it up. The surly voice said,
"Kill that spot, Bo. Folks get hurt that way."
I snapped the flash off and straightened. Light went on inside the garage, outlined a tall man in overalls. He backed away from the open door and kept a gun leveled at me.
"Step inside and shut the door, stranger. We'll see what we can do."
I stepped inside and shut the door behind my back. I looked at the gaunt man, but not at the other man who was shadowy over by a workbench, silent. The breath of the garage was sweet and sinister with the smell of hot pyroxylin paint.
"Ain't you got no sense?"
the gaunt man chided me.
"A bank job was pulled at Rialito this noon."
"Pardon," I said, remembering the people staring at the bank in the rain. "I didn't pull it. I'm a stranger here."
"Well, there was," he said morosely. "Some say it was a couple of punk kids and they got 'em cornered back here in the hills."
"It's a nice night for hiding," I said. "I suppose they threw tacks out. I got some of them. I thought you just needed the business."
"You didn't ever get socked in the kisser, did you?"
the gaunt man asked me briefly. "Not by anybody your weight." The purring voice from over in the shadows said,
"Cut out the heavy menace, Art. This guy's in a jam. You run a garage, don't you?"
"Thanks," I said, and didn't look at him even then.
"Okay, okay,"
the man in the overalls grumbled. He tucked his gun through a flap in his clothes and bit a knuckle, staring at me moodily over it. The smell of the pyroxylin paint was as sickening as ether. Over in the corner under a drop light, there was a big new-looking sedan with a paint gun lying on its fender. I looked at the man by the workbench now. He was short and thick-bodied with strong shoulders. He had a cool face and cool dark eyes. He wore a belted brown suede raincoat that was heavily spotted with rain. His brown hat was tilted rakishly. He leaned his back against the workbench and looked me over without haste, without interest, as if he was looking at a slab of cold meat. Perhaps he thought of people that way. He moved his dark eyes up and down slowly and then glanced at his fingernails one by one, holding them up against the light and studying them with care, as Hollywood has taught it should be done. He spoke around a cigarette.
"Got 2 flats, huh? That's tough. They swept them tacks, I thought."
I skidded a little on the curve.
"Stranger in town, you said?"
"Traveling through, on the way to L.A. How far is it?"
40 miles. Seems longer this weather. Where you from, stranger?"
"Santa Rosa."
"Come the long way, eh? Tahoe and Lone Pine?"
"Not Tahoe, Reno and Carson City."
"Still the long way.
A fleeting smile curved his lips. "Any law against it?" I asked him.
"Huh? No, sure not. Guess you think we're nosy just on account of that heist back there. Take a jack and get his flats, Art."
"I'm busy," the gaunt man growled. "I've got work to do. I've got this spray."